If you don't raise your hand, I'm not going to allow you. Okay, no, that's fine. Okay, in that example, it's honorable to test our members. I'm calling you. Yeah. But the people from KZN have been learned, have learned that not just from KZN, I think all of us in Africans, we prepare our totem in our surnames.
Yeah.
Our totem. I said to honorable member of parliament, one of the senior citizens, Baba, that is honorable Putelis. And then he objected, says to me, I'm Jenge.
Yeah.
And I thought if I called him Jenge, I would have insulted him. Did not know. Okay.
Then I'm Nyambo as well. I want to understand especially your key issue in slide 3, where they didn't, or and well, that's the fine line between on-site and the on-site visit. Because when you are on-site visit, your main objective is to do the inspection. What happens if you find that the whole information that you have been given was incorrect, and there are no documentation by that particular company? How do you deal with that? Do you have right to seize certain documentation that were used legally, so before obtaining the certificate, or what happens? That's it. I want to clarify on that.
Chavalala. Is technology rejecting you? No.
It's working now. Yeah, I think you can hear me now. Yeah, I think it never was good. Professor, I thought you were saying insane. You don't have to control the video. Yeah, I think I'm saying yeah. That is said. Yeah. All right. Thank you, Professor. Let me try to be very quick. I think mine is for clarity. One, let me check with the legislation we're doing around the issue of regulators. You've got regulators and you've got insurance. That regulators would have their own amendments, and you have insurance at the same time, then you would have the banks in the middle. So therefore, who takes what and when? Because I'm sure it affects them differently. So when do they comply and align? Do they, especially when we start with the regulations and through legislation? The second answer to that, you mentioned the issue of medical aid. I think they just touched it and just left it. This medical aid, the doctors, I want to find out about pharmaceuticals as well. Has it been looked at as far as pricing is concerned and so forth? Or does the issue of the introduction of NHI deal with that? Probably extensively. I just want to get an indication. But then the issue of the, the Insurance and the Bank Act. you mentioned that there's going to be, what do you call it, Momo? PIPL, something like that. PO, COPI. Yeah, you mentioned about COPI. But I want to find out in length around the issue of the advertisement, specifically on the fact that, you know, at times it doesn't intimidate people, it's expensive on the TV and so forth and so on. Is that going to be looked at as well, going further, specifically, I mean, you would have insurance that solves issues like your accident covers, and there will just be on people cases, and the issue of personal information there. But while I'm on the personal information and the protection of such, you would have your national credit regulator as well, and where you have, what do you call it, shops, so that it's easy to get information. As a matter of fact, in South Africa, I don't think there's an individual that is highly protected as far as identity is concerned. It's just a click of a button. Any shop can get who you are, where you are, your ID number, very easy. So as much as COPI deals with that, I would want to find out is that are you going to be point of reference in this legislation, which one is going to come first, depending on Parliament, of course, but are you going to find each other and how you plan to do that? But I'm just saying on the identity, I've got serious issues. Let me not touch on other things because of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief, and thank you to the DDG and his team. Chair, indeed, you are so right. We are to look at the 11 current bills. And you like what Momo said, that even from the taxation to related taxation amendment bills. Now, it's a request, Chair, that I don't know how the if it's possible, if they group the similarities, if some of the bills do have some similarities, so that as the committee we have a better understanding from the original or the principal act to the and reason for the amendments, if that is possible, I don't know. Especially if you look at your slide 15, Chair, where the bill will limit the powers of other regulators. We need to understand the powers that they were given to these regulators, so that at the end of the day, even if there's an argument or a dispute about saying there are more powers given to the registrar, we are able to ask, as the committee understand that, you know, indeed, these powers were to be limited because of reason 1, 2, and 3. But for now, because this is one another for the first time on this matter, we not understand. So I hope that if you can just try and elaborate on that one. You look at the proposal that has to be done on our reserve bank. We need to be clear, but because we also do the oversight that side, to understand. Right now, it's still quiet, but I understand because it's an initial presentation. Last say, step number 17, bullet number 3. Can I get a clarity? So you're saying, because this regulated process has acted within bona fide, has acted within the law, Nunku, he has acted within the law, so no person shall be liable for any laws because he has acted within the law. So because of that, now I'm asking myself, you know, sometimes you'll find that the law is okay and then find there are loopholes. Now if we remove but not grossly negligent, how does that then leave the community as far as the proceeding is concerned? Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Ross. Thank you, Chair. What's your daughter? Excuse me. My first name is David, so you can address me. It's a king's name, yeah. Thank you, Chair. Yes, my question is with regards to the regulator and the time of the essence concept that we need this regulation very, very urgently. And linking that perhaps to the issues that could have been dealt with regards to the Twin Peaks model, could we not wait for this to be implemented and then scale down on the regulation that we envisage now within the same? I fully agree with protection, the second one, with regard to the policyholders. I think it's much needed and it will mean a lot for citizens out there. But you know, the points made in terms of time of the essence that you need to act quickly and move with the speed of light, you know, certainly rules are not made with the speed of light, and why leave it to the regulator then and diminish then on the other hand the powers of the minister and the democratic process within Parliament to make the rules, you know? Because I also read the article of Professor Vivian, and he, you know, the insurance industry certainly thinks this is a complete attack on the sustainability of the insurance industry. Previously, Section 35 of the Short-Term Insurance Act introduced that the regulator could introduce rules, provided it be approved by the minister and public comment. And the new bill now removes the minister from this process. This is a complete new dimension then. With serious implication, and if you now go to the more academic debates, you know, about liberty and freedom of speech and all that, it could become problematic. The regulator will now have authority to pass its own legislation. That's the perception out there. And can we have a look at that again? And simply the regulator to make rules by notice in a government gazette is a bit extraordinary. And then there was also concerns regarding the regulator can operate in terms of a bill of attainder. Has that been scrapped? I didn't find it in the Act when I looked at that specific regulation, but it was in the press statement. And Well, the question that they then posed, and that's a concern from the public, is can we make the regulator then both legislature and part of the executive implement those rules? It is a concern, and the proposal that Section 55(3)(b) should be scrapped. Just your views on that. Thank you, sir.
Honourable Harris, you'll also indicate to me if you want me to use your doctor.
Well, Chair, no, I'm from KZN, that's where I went to school. And you know the Premier, you know he supports us on our campaign for the youth wage subsidy.
Oh, I see.
So I think that means I'm a cover zealot.
The Premier of KZN, don't forget, is a member of the ANC.
The Premier, yes.
So you're supporting the ANC.
Well, I'm supporting his very strong views on the youth wage subsidy.
But it's a portion of the ANC, that's why.
I'll work with whoever has good ideas. Chair, I mean, obviously it's going to be quite an extensive process. We need to hear the views of the industry, stakeholders, World Lab, unions, everybody. There's clearly some contentious stuff here. My one question is when the DDG mentioned the pack that we're getting, when will we get the pack, which will include, I'd imagine, the inputs you've had so far. But there was a piece, I think it was yesterday in the Business Day, where a law lecturer at UCT made the following comments about legislation. And I'd just like to read them. It's very brief, Chair. He said, legislation is passed conferring broad, vague powers to government officers. Objections to the breadth and vagueness of these measures are met with responses that the authorities can be trusted to wield their powers fairly. Now, this is a view that's out there. And I think it's a view that we must take on board, and we must caution that this law doesn't simply add to the impression by some in the legal community that this is what we're doing as legislators, rather. We worked hard and long on the two previous bills, financial markets and credit rating services. And I think in general what this committee managed to do was highlight the role of competition as a regulatory tool. I think that's something which you don't see in the presentation. I don't know the legislation very well yet, but it seems to be, from my initial impression, a reliance on regulatory intervention rather than the use of competition to promote outcomes by regulators. That is my first concern. My second is that in general, my colleague spoke about liberties. I think the problem is one of civil liberties and justice. We cannot abandon those principles even as we set out to create strong regulators. That's something which we certainly will be fighting to keep at the heart of this legislation. And it's a deficit that I pick up throughout the presentation. The issue of NEDLAC, Chair, I understand it's been taken to NEDLAC, but perhaps not formally. There's a reference to how it might need to go back to NEDLAC. What is the NEDLAC process? I mean, surely NEDLAC needs to finalise their view on the bill first, and if not, why not? My colleague from the clan, David, did cover the two criticisms that have been in the press from Professor Vivian in particular. The one is that the bill gives excessive legislative power to the FSB, and the other one is that, as he referenced, this bill of attainder, which I wasn't aware of before, but which essentially gives the regulator powers, as it said in the press, to find a party guilty and punish the party without any judicial due process. As I said, it's a new concept for me. I would like to get a response from Treasury on those two criticisms in particular. And then lastly, Chair, I'm quite surprised to see the Treasury double down on the use of this word draconian. I must remind the Honourable DDG that the definition of draconian, as I said before, is excessively harsh and severe. I don't think that should be the role of any regulator. Your regulation needs to consist of options along the continuum from no regulation to harsh regulation, with kind of light touch and moderate in between. Certainly, if something is overly harsh and severe, excessively harsh, then it's simply not a regulatory approach which we could support, which any legislators could, in good faith, establish that framework. We don't want to be excessive. We want to be appropriately harsh. I still think it's a very unfortunate use of the word. And it doesn't preclude, taking out the reference to draconian legislation doesn't preclude moving quickly at the speed of light, as you say, or regulating appropriately and harshly. It just simply, to me, raises a red flag about a tendency throughout these bills as we lead up to the Twin Peaks process, where we are excessive. And I don't think anybody wants to be excessive. We need to be appropriately harsh where required. I don't believe that word is appropriate. Thank you, Chip.
Yeah, that was the last. And I can see nobody has been for vote. Over to you.
I think just deal with the issue of regulation and so on, and whether it's harsh, draconian, and so on. I think that, yes, it's appropriately harsh. And I think precisely because I think many of us in this room fought very hard for human rights, to give those rights or to be seen to be compromising on those rights is something that we really, really have to apply our minds to. Because I think many of us will defend the Constitution to the death. Having said that, I think that what we're doing is not out of line with what G20 countries are doing. No other regulator can call in a bank on a Friday night and say, thou shalt close, ignore all the insolvency provisions, thou shalt merge with so and so. And no, it didn't happen in South Africa, it happened in the US. It almost happened with Lehman's, but it happened with, was it Sears or what was it, Morgan Stanley? But you read accounts, that's what's happened. And those are the draconian powers you have. Of course, fortunately, unlike the U.S., we don't regard corporates as persons. In the U.S., as you know, they are persons, so they have equal rights, and therefore you have super PACs, as you had in the U.S. election. I think that we are saying very clearly that anyone who plays in a financial sector must have a license, an appropriate license. In fact, the problems we have are all people who extend credit regulated. Do they pass the fit and proper test? You'll find many players out there operating who clearly shouldn't be there. They don't have a democratic right to operate. And I think that we're very clear that this sector does need to be regulated. The thinking has changed fundamentally before 2007, from before 2007-8. Which you kind of saw with people like Alan Greenspan championing light-touch regulation, but you realize the incentive structure in the financial sector is such that people can not just abuse, but affect the livelihoods of millions of people. If you look at market conduct practices in South Africa, they are atrocious. If you look at some of the papers we published on retirement, where else can someone take 60% of all your growth in your pension funds and do it legitimately? So I think that we've got to factor in there's always an asymmetry of info. Consumers are never going to be as advanced as the financial sector. And it's a case of equalizing and allowing the weak, the Davids, to fight Goliath here. Okay, that's why you have an ombuds system and so on. I didn't mean you, David. So I think, you know, we can debate this, and that's why I use the word draconian, because we don't want to pretend to be a wolf in sheep's clothing. We don't want to say it's all nice, it won't have extreme powers when it's appropriate. We're saying it. We want to be upfront, because that should be a democratic discussion. And the democratic discussion should include why this sector needs to be regulated more than other sectors and what are the harsh provisions that we have. Yes, the regulators do try and always get the business to continue to function. At worst, they remove the management, but they allow the company to continue. And I think we take very seriously what people like Professor Vivian has done. In fact, I responded to him, and we'll make these articles available. He's just put virtually the same article in the Business Day. Some people don't know, legal experts don't know what he's talking about. That's why we say, please invite him. Let him explain himself. I do think he's talking nonsense in some instances, but, you know, let's look at what he says. Let him also declare his interests, because I don't think his issues are valid. And we can call Brian Martin here, the previous ombud, short-term ombud. I'm sure he would love to come and say which product he took on, who came to see him to intimidate him. You know, those are all facts that shouldn't be done behind closed doors. They should be out there in the open. And yes, we do want the market conduct regulators to have norms and standards. And make no mistake, what we're saying is, and Parliament does allow delegation of powers and so on, whether it's to the minister or to some entity. Yes, there must be appropriate checks and balances. We do want to make the regulators and the supervisors much more comfortable when they deal with subordinate legislation. But, you know, we get into the domain of how subordinate is subordinate. Because some of the provisions, it's almost like you have a league, you start having rules, is that legislation, because it applies to all the players who are already there. I think the issue of whether you publish in the government gazette is actually not really the big issue. That is not the issue, but the powers that regulators have. And so what they have, and we'd love to come and explain to you, in G20, you can take country by country, and you'll see the powers that regulators have. And they really are draconian at times. They're appropriately draconian, but they're also corrective, so that you take steps to correct measures. Or they can be, if you look at the UK, where banks were charged over this insurance product that they had. Or as you see, there's money laundering cases that various regulators have taken up. Or there's the LIBOR case. You know, these are big, big issues, and the powers of the regulators are enormous. To the point, I should add, that when a regulator acts against you. In fact, your fear is, like you've seen with the New York Fed, the New York State regulators, who acted without even checking with their federal regulators against one or two British banks. I do wonder if they would have been as hard on a U.S. bank. But the companies just plead guilty because, you know, it's going to take too long and it's problematic to take on any regulator. So regulators have enormous power. And I think that's why we say they must be accountable. Aside from limiting their liability, I think that you should call them much more to Parliament and call them on specific instances so that they account politically as well about how they're exercising their power. But having said that, if you do take action against anybody, they all come back and make all kinds of allegations, and you've got to take that with a pinch of salt. So, Chair, I'm not saying these are easy issues. They are hard issues. I think they need to be thoroughly debated. They do affect certain liberties, be it of corporations or certain persons. But it is the trend. We are not being an exception in having this approach in South Africa. And yes, it does need to comply with our constitution, which introduces further tests that we have to pass. And I think we'd be very open to those discussions. We're not tied in. But to the extent that we are going to be especially financial institutions tend to be very globally integrated, and in fact this is the point that's made, that financial institutions operate globally, but they're regulated nationally, which means that, you know, if you take Basel III, you've got to now have global standards. There is the issue of sovereignty that does apply. You do give up some, make no mistake, because you subscribe to international standards. And given that we're a small country, those standards are not often the best for us. They are determined by the big players. So, Chair, just I think both Honorable Harris and King David, Honorable King David, I would say that certainly those are issues that we are worried about. I think that in terms of the speed of life, again, that gets to the issue of regulation. That our, and it's not just South Africa, that to have rules often at the level of parliament or the legislature does take time. And that's why you have regulators in this instance, and they do have some legislative powers. And again, you know, there's a lot of shade of gray in between where one can determine what powers they should have. So let me give you an example. It could be that when you implement Basel III, that the additional buffer that you have is a decision you need to, is a, you know, that perhaps government needs to make, parliament needs to take into account, because the trade-off is between how safe you want the sector and how much growth you want in the short term. And to the extent that you, once you determine the framework, the actual supervisors slash regulators go out and determine the quality rules, which can be this thick if you look at Basel III. And I promise you, the only people who probably read it are the people who are licensed. It should be made available to everyone. But you know, in most instances, we would all struggle to read those unless you're involved in industry. But the thrust of it, the broad framework, should be have some sort of political endorsement. I think that's quite important. So I think it's a degree of to what extent or where do you draw the line and how guarded do you want to be and how slow or fast do you want the system to respond. I think that with regard to issues like lead regulator and how to deal with the issue of competition, I think that we definitely feel that the more competition, the better it is. But having said that, if you look at the banking sectors, the ones that survived best were more concentrated. If you want to have another bank, you need people with real capital to set up a bank. It's not going to be easy to have another bank. It's taken Investec a long time to become maybe number 4.5, 4, 5 now. Okay, there are two other banks that are kind of coming into the space. It takes a long, long time, and as I said, you can look at Sweden, you can look at Australia, you can look at Canada, you have a few major retail banks. It would be great to have more competition, but you also then need to have a balance between competition and safety. So when the U.S. Fed call up these banks and you say, thou shalt merge with X, shall merge with Y, or take over Y, you are then going to have less the banks. So it does work against, it does mean less competition, but it's that trade-off between safety and competition. And it's a hard one. It does require a judgment call. And after the judgments are made, I'm saying people should be made accountable to Parliament in some way so that these things are not treated as something that you would not deal with. And when we set up the lead regulators, we're trying to make sure, I take consumer protection, that we have higher standards, that we are achieving the objectives or the spirit of the other legislation that we have exemptions over. So on business rescue, we do want to make sure you try to save the institution, not close it down. So those, I think, are implicitly there, yes, but the test will be whether the regulators actually deal with those issues. I think that with regard to some of the questions on, let me go in the order, let me now go in order. I think that with regard to, if you look at someone with Honorable Matepwa on the on-site with this inspection, you want to deal with that?
I deal with the on-site visit one. I will, and I can also deal with the question on guilt without due process. Just to clarify the position there. Now, with regard to the on-site visit vis-a-vis investigations, on-site visit, as I said earlier, they are not meant to be investigations. Remember, they preceded by statutory submissions. So, in a way, it is where the regulator says, yes, you've submitted this document, I have seen it. But I still want to satisfy myself even further to say, indeed, what you're telling me, you have done. That's the first leg. Second leg to your question is, what if in that process something jumps out that is more serious than we thought it is there. Now, the difference here is when FSB employees go out to conduct an on-site visit, they are not officially appointed as inspectors in terms of the Inspection Act. So whatever they discover there, if it's serious, they're going to bring that information back so that inspectors are formally appointed and sent out to do proper investigation. That's the line between the difference between the two. With regard to the issue of guilty without process, I think this matter speaks directly to the earlier issue of inspection reports being made public to everybody there to read. Because honorable members, like every citizen out there, they hear shouts in the media, in the newspapers, over the radios, here I'm an innocent person, I'm being found guilty by the FSB, and I have not been through any process. But in the meantime, the public has actually not seen the investigation report. This is why we ask in that we have a provision that says, let's make the investigation report so that whoever goes out there and tries to make noises of being prosecuted and found guilty in the public space, it's actually, it should be able to be confronted by what is in it. Because inspection report, I must tell you, that elaborate document, no statement is made in those reports without an attachment, a support to that, to whatever is said in the report. So those two things speak to each other. So it's important that we get the power to publish in the investigation report. The other issue of the liability, I'm going to try and put it in the simplest of forms. I think the point of departure is there is a provision in the FSB Act which says anybody who gets aggrieved by the decision of the regulator has the right to challenge that decision. And the challenge to those decisions are done in terms of what you do domestically. And if you succeed, good luck. If you don't succeed, of course, it gets elevated to the court of laws. What we're trying to address here is for people not to assume that whatever decision the registrar may have taken with good intentions, which of course, the intentions may be good, but the outcomes may be perceived as being negligent and or may be perceived to be harmful. We say, that's fine. You still have the right to challenge that decision. But it is wrong to say, because of this, the registrar is automatically liable. We don't have that legal principle in the country, and it's not even a principle anywhere in the world where you're saying you are guilty until you prove your innocence. You've got to be presumed to be innocent until proven guilty. This is not meant to stop anybody from challenging any decision of the regulator internally and to the courts. That's what we attempt to say. Thank you very much.
I think maybe if I can just add, not to respond to specific questions, but just on two issues. I think if you look at the mandate that Parliament have given Financial Services Board, it's based on two critical elements. It's to protect the public by ensuring fair, sustainable financial markets. So I don't think this is industry versus the consumer issue or the industry versus the regulator. I think we need to realize that when industry engages with individuals, that there is an inequality in respect of sophistication on one side and the other side. When you sign an insurance contract, 2,000 lawyers have looked at that from the perspective of the insurer, for instance. Whether individual, somebody advises you on what it says, what are your rights, what will you get out in the end, etc. So you're one person against a system. I think it's for us saying, let's establish all we want to achieve is to ensure that fairness. And to do that, it is important that somebody be able to look at the advice that's provided, able to look at the price that is provided. And sometimes it is important to interfere in that relationship. I mean, if we look at the Professor Vivian and think about contractual freedom, it's important to also have fair contractual relationships. And I think what they are saying that currently we do find, and it's, we're not saying the industry is completely rotten, that all of them are trying to exploit consumers. We are saying, like all legislation, it's written there for the few people that are not upstanding citizens. And that's the legislative framework. It's written for those people that you know, to talk to them, or from an ethical perspective, they're not going to do the right thing. It's very really sure that people that do not do the right thing actually can be forced to do the right thing. And I think if we talk about equality and civil liberties and justice, we need to remember the two major groups here. And I think that is our role as government. Yes, I'm a regulator. I implement legislation. But it's Parliament that mandates me to do that. And I need to ensure that consumers, that's my job. Every night when I go to bed, I need to know that the little woman in Giani that wanted to bury her son got what she deserved. That's our job. I think just to clarify that. And in speaking of inspections and on-site, I think we need to realize that the regulatory or the supervisory process is quite a complex one. And it is built on trust. It's built on engagement with the people that we regulate. Very few people object for us to go on an on-site visit. It's as my executive author explained, it's a sort of just a check and balance. But sometimes when we get there, we realize not enough money to cover policyholder liabilities or to cover all the assets on loan. And I think it's then when the process needs to start. There's a number of regulatory interventions. So first people will say, can you give us a plan in terms of how you're going to fix it, by when are you going to fix it, how quickly are you going to get shareholders to put in money. To come to an inspection is when you realize something is seriously wrong. Money is disappearing. People are disappearing. And I think it's at that point you know, that the inspection kicks in. But it is important to, on that on-site visit part, be able to do that engagement. But if you pick up something, at least speak with authority to say, you have to do X, Y, and Z. So I think maybe just to highlight what the distinction is further in terms of that.
Okay, on the rest of the questions, on the issue of medical aid, well, first on the issue of who is responsible for banking insurance. At the moment, there are current acts, there's a Banks Act, there's a Long-Term Insurance Act, Short-Term Insurance Act. Each of them gives power to various regulators. For banking, currently it's in the South. For insurance, effectively, it's the person on my right, but he has deputies who then are report to him and effectively act as day-to-day registrars for short-term insurance, long-term insurance, pensions, collective investment schemes, securities, you know, you name it, okay? Sorry? How does? Well, what it's doing, remember, is aligning some of the legislation then for the Companies Act, Consumer Protection Act, where it's vague who is responsible for what, and then it deals with more cross-cutting things or specific things like the liability issues. So if you look at the Act, the way it's structured is that it's structured per act. So that's per part. Okay, that's parts. Each part then deals with the particular act. It shows you the amendment. And as I said, a lot of those are common approaches across, and that's what we just focused on today on themes. I think it may be useful, obviously, when we get to the clause by clause or specific, that we look at the actual act and then say, this is how this act has been amended. Because reading this as amendments, they're difficult. And that's why I think the clause by clause, what do you call it? Yeah, the clause by clause. And maybe that just answers the issue is, I thought there is a practice in circulated here to members, which includes the explanatory memo, which is a clause by clause. It also deals with the matrix of the comments made. They have given all the more detailed comments submitted. So all of it is there. I don't know where in the system it's, I don't know if the committee section. I'm saying all the rest of the pack, was it sent to you? Was it not sent to you? Okay. If we can, we'll send it to you. I don't know what's the problem there. With regard to issues like medical aid, I don't want to get into the issues here, but essentially the issue is that you know, medical schemes, what happens is the young effectively subsidize the old. And what you don't want is any scheme to select and just have the old so that they only make payments and the young who should be contributing don't. That's why the discussion on national health insurance. But to the extent that you have medical aids even currently, there's a demarcation between general insurance products and medical schemes are a form of insurance. So, and it's dealing with that gap or so-called gap cover, the hospital plan that pays you $50,000 if you go to hospital. Okay, and what you find is the more people who take that, then people tend not to take the medical aid and so on. So there are hard issues, and we've had comments, including from Section 27, the Helen Suzman Foundation, and Professor van der Heever, who also have made comments on those issues. We are meeting with them as well to just take up some of the issues. I think with regard to issues like Edwards, I think we all get irritated by that. I think the Personal Information Act, the POPI, Protection of Personal Information Act, will deal with some of it because they need your permission. But, you know, today you go into a security complex, they even scan your ID in some complexes. So I don't know how the law is going to pan out, but we definitely all need to be protected, I think, from these issues. I think just the other outstanding issues that I can remember with regard to NEDLAC. We're not obliged to take these bills to NEDLAC because the law is clear what issues go to NEDLAC when it affects the key constituencies. Certainly, when you look at our retirement papers on the issue of preservation, auto-enrollment, we've put it, we've formally tabled it, and we don't believe you can proceed with those issues unless and until there's consensus. We hope it won't get stuck like the wage subsidy, but or the youth subsidy. But that's an issue that we've been engaging with the unions, who generally, I should say, I don't think are opposed to these things. I think the issue is just the timing of when you introduce these things. The other issues, like the papers we have on retirement costs, you know, again, we've raised it at various NEDLAC meetings, but we don't need the endorsement of NEDLAC to decide that you bring down retirement costs. In fact, the only people who might object might be industry. So are we then going to delay that change? So, and certainly with this particular bill, I don't believe that there are issues, but we are engaging with the constituency and everybody else to deal with these issues so that they are familiar, you know, nobody is unaware of the issues. And in fact, we would say it would be good if they do come to Parliament. I think they'd already be happy with the version that they've seen. And we've had unions strongly endorsing the amendments we have, like on employers, being sanctions against employers who don't hand over contributions. So I think those sorts of things are sorted out. Which I think we've dealt with everything. Janine wants.
Thank you. In the interest of time, indeed, I'm going to be very, very brief. Just to cover a little bit with respect to the Protection of Personal Information Act. That statute, as the DG stated, will go a long way towards protecting the dissemination of information. It also takes precedence, and I think that's one of your questions as to where does it fit within the other legislation. In other words, it is higher, it's got a higher stature with respect to its applicability when there's any conflict with any other legislation. And to the extent that regulatory activity needs some level of protection from the provisions of that statute, there are exceptions that have been built into the statute to enable regulation. I hope that answers your question. And the other part that I just wanted to close the gap on was the one that Honourable Madeline had raised, where the question is it true that just because somebody has acted within the law, then they're not going to be liable? And it's important that we state this properly. That is not what the amendment says. What has happened with regard to what we have now is the legislation. The legislation says, you shall not be liable for your bona fide but not grossly negligent act. Now, that part, when it says bona fide but not cross inefficient. It assumes that all the other requirements for you to be liable are assumed. There are certain requirements that must be there for liability, for you to be held liable in a court of law. There's the legal duty to act, or there's a legal duty for you to act or not to act. There are all those inquiries that must take place and that must be proven before a court of law. Now, the way our legislation is now drafted, it assumes certain things, certain base requirements to be there. But then it says we limit your liability if you have not acted grossly negligently. Now, even with the concept of gross negligence, there are difficulties. But what is negligence and what is gross negligence? Where does negligence go into gross negligence? So it just seems appropriate and necessary that this particular piece of legislation must be amended, that particular section, to actually go in congruence with the Constitution, because the Constitution expects that whether it's liability or wrongfulness or a legal duty on a person, it must be that was there a legal duty on that person? Does society expect that person under a lifeguard, for instance, seeing a child drown in a pool? Does society expect the lifeguard to jump into the pool and pick up the child? Those are the questions that you get to ask. And me not being able to see a child is drowning, what does society expect of me? Those are the questions that get asked. Is there a legal duty to act under any circumstance or not to act? I hope I've kind of thank you.
Thank you very much. There's one other query I just wanted to respond to, and that was in relation to the amendment to the South African Reserve Bank Act. The amendment relates to, in Section 13 of the South African Reserve Bank Act, it lists some prohibited business that the Reserve Bank currently cannot engage in. And in particular, it says that subject to certain other provisions, it may generally not lend or advance money on security of a mortgage on movable property or of a notarial or other bond or cession thereof or acquire a movable property. And so what it proposed in the amendment is that that prohibition would be removed, and so then the Reserve Bank would potentially in a situation where there needs to be liquidity provided to the financial markets, it could potentially lend or advance money on the security of a mortgage or acquire a movable property, etc. So it's just trying to open up an avenue of providing liquidity in a financial crisis situation. Thank you.
Okay. I get honorable members. You would have loved to engage more, but I think we're going to have enough time on our side to draw our own progress, because I think there's a lot of things that we need to learn before we can say we are in a position to can go back to Parliament and say this is a piece of legislation that we have worked on. But I wanted to check from you, Momo, what sort of time frames are you looking at? Not draconian time frames.
See, I think we'd be happy if you could process it by March, because we want to then come with the June peak legislation as well. But if it could be dealt with early next year. But look, you know, it's not like there'll be falling off a cliff if it's not done by March or April.
Yeah. You know the cliff thing today. Fiscal cliff, all that. Economists are becoming very, very creative in terms of new divinations, you know. Yeah. Now, I think the intention of the bill is very, very urgent, the issues that are covered here. We are all alive of the situation that is taking place in pension funds, fiduciary responsibilities of trustees. I don't think that is a space where people have been conducting themselves in a proper manner. In fact, if we talk about wastages in the public sector, it might not even be comparable to what individuals are doing in that area.
simply robbing the most vulnerable. People have saved their lifetime savings, and they get subjected to all sorts of things. And I think there's been very horrible regulatory environment to deal with that aspect. So if Parliament can assist, in fact, it's not an if, I think we've got a duty to make sure that we act reasonably in terms of time management. Nothing will be perfect at the end of the day, but we need to begin to be think we're doing something about the situation. The insurance space, I think, in fact, I was saying to Tess that this is long overdue, the interventions in that sector. And we should, as Parliament and honorable members, understand that we're not only acting against the industry. We are also acting in the interest of the consumers. And I think that's what it should really drive our motives as parliamentarians. Because there are unequal relations out there in terms of products. Unequal relations. As you said, this one of the simplest examples in terms of the motor industry. Comprehensive may mean even when yourself you have died in the accident. That's comprehensive. If your life was not comprehensive because you survived. We thought we'll cover this thing comprehensively. If you don't survive yourself, we'll deal with the family and others. So these are some of the loopholes in there. I've raised this thing with the FSB as the committee visited there at some point. But there are a number of issues that we need to look into. But for the committee to be able to deal with these issues, I think we'd need, under the new time frame, at least a day's workshop on our side just to go through these issues. Even before we go into public hearings on the matter. It might be a day or two. We have never given ourselves an opportunity as the committee to go and workshop some of these legislations. So I think we should actually create space for that. Obviously, it will be early next year. We'll have to find a way to squeeze, in our program. But one fully understand exactly what you need to do in this area. Having said so, I think we'll come to the end of our deliberations. We will inform you in terms of the processes. And I think it's going to be a process that many would want to come and make presentations. It will be a very interesting process. Of course, the consumers may not be able to, but bodies that represent consumers, we must find a way to make sure that they put their views across on these issues. Honourable members, I think we have done our work, but it's just one announcement for committee members. We are requested to participate in the nomination process of members of the board of the Land Bank. Not just these committee members, Rural and Development committees also fit to this matter. And because we are not going to fit to the committee, so this is the name, I would encourage honorable members to actually make admissions of names of the suitable candidates to the secretary of our committee, and then we'll then package those names and send them to National Treasury for consideration. Judy says they want to submit to Mary's name. You know, in another meeting, she said she's always looking forward to come to these meetings and look radiant. I was not very sure what is the interpretation of that. But I think that's the process that we should follow in terms of the nomination for the board members. Send to Ellen, and then Ellen will send to, by the 30th of this month. But it's important that Ellen will circulate this thing to honorable so that they can also see the criteria that is actually acquired. Momo and your team, thank you very much. We fully understand you, we'll support you in the process. And Eric Waller once said, when people are speaking about democratic socialism, he said, why should you qualify socialism? Isn't inherently democratic? Why do you have to preface it and say democratic socialism? Now, if the intention of the law is to be firm and achieve certain objectives, why categorize it and give it a prefix and say draconian? Because the intention is the same. You may actually attract unnecessary attention on what you want to achieve by actually giving it a particular prefix. I'm just saying this is something that you need to look into. Thank you. All right.